So Jonathan, I'll hand over to you.
Well, note that Cambridge has been stealing shit from Oxford since 1209.
Yeah.
So I'll say very little about the sort of faith side of things, and spend most of my time trying to introduce what the psychology of religion is, and then we can have. So the rest of you, are you humanities scholars of some kind? How many of you are humanities scholars of some kind? All right, cool. Not to be too disparaging about the humanities. People who do the humanities mostly, read texts and think critically. Scientists do neither of these things. most of what we do is we make guesses about the world, right? More or less informed guesses about the world, and then we try and work out by careful observation whether or not our guesses are true. Right? Very simple premise to how to do science, right? So you guess that, you know, a rock and a feather, when you drop them, will arrive at the ground at the same time, and then you observe to see if it's true. It turns out it's not true, and then you try to work out why, and you think maybe it's air friction, etc. Right? So we guess, and then we run what you might call empirical tests, and these observations help us to work out whether or not a hypothesis or a theory is true. There are lots of kinds of scientists, right? So astronomers study planets and such like. Particle physicists study small things that may or may not exist. Chemists study chemical reactions, right? Anatomists study bits of your body. Psychologists study, we like to say, mental processes, right? What happens in your head. I think that may be more controversial than you might think. I mean, it might be better to take one step forward. Away from abstraction, and to say that what psychologists do is we study behavior, right? We study why people do the things that they do, say the things that they say, and very often the sorts of theories that we come up with involve facts about your environment, facts about your history, but also just, you know, basic processes about what happens inside your head. So we think that claims can be made about cognition, about emotion, such that they help us to explain observable behavior, right? So humans are weird, right? What sorts of weird things do we do? So how many of you have a glass of alcohol in your hands? Right, okay, so alcohol is poison. It's an incredibly stupid thing to consume. I do it a lot, and some of you do it too. But you know, very clever people drink alcohol. We wear clothes, right? Look around you. You'll see that you're wearing all kinds of clothes. It's not at all obvious why we wear the kinds of clothes that we do, right? When from a purely utilitarian perspective, we could just all wear the same thing, and they could be designed better to be more comfortable. It's true that I need to lose an inch and a half, so says my tailor, but like my trousers definitely don't fit me properly. And some of you can relate to this, probably because we live in a sexist place, probably the women can relate to this more than the men can, etc. Right? Like, we do weird things. And one of the weird things that we do are religious things, right? So we build these massive and expensive edifices to the gods, and we slaughter goats, and we good extremely boring services every Sunday morning. We symbolically drown our children. We refuse to do fun things like have sex before marriage. We try not to drink too much alcohol, etc. And these are, when you stop and think about them, sort of puzzling things that people do. When you know, the evolutionary prerogative is to propagate as much genetic material as possible, the injunctions against sex are extremely sort of evolutionarily puzzling. When you think about how enjoyable lots of things are that are forbidden by various sorts of religions, it becomes puzzling from that perspective, from a sort of purely like hedonistic perspective. So regardless of whether or not you personally find religion puzzling, I would like to say that it is sort of, as it were, objectively a puzzling thing about human animals that we do this thing. So what psychologists of religion do is try and work out about like why do humans do this particular thing? Why do humans do the thing that we might call religion? And you can ask that question in lots of different ways, right? You can ask very like general questions, like where does religion come from? Like, why do people believe in gods? Why do people participate in rituals? Why do people build big buildings dedicated to their gods? Or you can ask sort of very specific questions about very different flavors of religiosity, right? So so it turns out it's the case that at least in some major religions, women are on various measures of religion more religious than men are. So you might want to ask, well, why is that? Right? Here's a very specific thing that you observe in the world, and you might want to know why that's true. You can observe again in the West that as age increases, religiosity increases, and you can ask, and you might want to know why that is. Is that just a cohort effect, such that people born, you know, in different generations are just more religious, or is it, as it were, an aging effect, right? So is it really the case that when people get older, the self same individuals also get more religious, and if so, why might that be? So you can ask these sorts of questions at all kinds of levels of generality and abstraction. And you can ask them from different disciplinary perspectives, right? So you can ask economic questions about religion. Do religious organizations serve a kind of economic function? You can ask sociological facts or political facts about. You can ask sociological or political questions about religion. You know, how are religion and politics in fact related to each other in any given country, in any given continent, etc. Or if you are a psychologist, you might want to ask psychological questions about religion. Where does religion, whatever that means, right? Where do the belief in gods, where do rituals, where do religious groups come from in the sort of human psyche, to use an old-fashioned sort of term? The scientists in the room. So how many of you are scientists who are psychologists, right? How many of you are scientists who are not psychologists, right? So how many of you are scientists who are sort of physical or chemical scientists, that sort of thing? Right. Okay. Right. So the hard scientists in the room might be skeptical that you can do psychology as a science, and I think, you know, and fair enough, right? I'll say a bit more about why it's hard to do psychology as a science later, but it is true to say, right, that humans are not really like quarks, right? Like humans are not like sulfuric acid, right? Humans are like messy and complicated and have individual histories, etc., that complicate matters. But I think the basic premise of how to do science applies across the scientific disciplines, right? I said earlier that what we do is we guess something about the world and then we try and make some observation. It's true that observations about humans are much more difficult to make. They're much more error prone, they're much more contingent upon the environmental condition than observations made by physicists and chemists, in part because, you know, like there are things that we can do to photons and protons that we can't do to humans. I mean, you try to apply for ethics to smash two humans together so that they break into bits so that you can measure electrical signals. No one will let you do that. I mean, I don't know why you want to do it, but the point is no one will let you do it. So studying humans is very hard. But the basic idea is the same, right? If you want to know something about if you want to know the cause of some human behavior, at least in principle, you can set up an experiment. Right, so what's an experiment? So here's a classic experiment, right? You take two petri dishes, you make up a batch of bacteria in a pot, right? And then you just grab two batches of bacteria. It's no reason to think that the two batches are different. You put them in two different petri dishes. In one petri dish, you put a whole bunch of penicillin on it, and in the other petri dish, you do nothing, and then you put them all in the same like refrigerator or whatever it is that people do with petri dishes, and then you wait some amount of time. Hopefully the exact same amount of time. Take them both out, and then you work out whether or not all the bacteria in one petri dish is alive, and then the other is dead. And they go, well, you know, the only difference was the penicillin, and so we attribute the death of all this bacteria to the penicillin, right? Very simple, right? So you can do the same with humans, right? Take a whole bunch of humans, right? And then you put a lot of them in one room, a lot of them in another room. Obviously, they're different individuals, but if you do it randomly, a priori, there's no good reason to think that they differ in any significant way. And then you fill, and then you go into one room and you shoot all of them. And then you go away and you come back, right? A day later to observe the humans in the room. And in one room, they're all dead, right? And another room, they're not all dead. So you can work out that the only difference between these two rooms is in one case, well, someone walked in and shot all of them. So the shooting caused the death, yes? So again, this is a very simple example. And then one level of abstraction later, you can go, okay, like, look, here are a whole bunch of humans, like we'll split into two rooms, here's one room, here's another room. We will give all these people some paracetamol, and then we play some very loud and terrible music to induce headaches, and then we ask them, right, like, do you have a headache? And it turns out that in this room where you gave everyone paracetamol, like fewer of them said that they had headaches than in the other room, so we can attribute the reduction of headaches to the paracetamol. Yes? Are you all following me? Right, okay, right. Note the question, right? You've asked them how painful, like how much pain they're experiencing, right? So it turns out that even like pharmacological experiments are in fact psychological experiments. You're asking them about experience that they've had, like as a thinking, feeling person, right? You're not just measuring their blood levels. You're not just measuring their, you know, like facial muscles or something like this. You're trying to work out how they feel about something. So basically, that's what psychologists do, right? Take humans, divide them into conditions more or less randomly, manipulate the situation in some way, and take some kind of measurement. So, in the sciences, for those of you who are not in the sciences, the word observation and the word measurement is used almost synonymously. Not entirely synonymously, but more or less synonymously. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about some of my favorite experiments in the psychology of religion, and then I'll talk about, you know, how hard the job is, so that you will feel some sympathy, and then we can talk about what it's like to be a priest while doing this kind of work. Before I talk about these experiments, I will say that I don't know if any of them are replicable. The reason I say that is because it turns out that a not terrible estimate of how many what proportion of psychological experiments are replicable is about a third. Right, so you read a scientific journal, read a psychological science journal, and you take 10 papers in them, and you read them, and you go, oh, you know, like, look, what an interesting finding. The probability that the finding is repeatable, right, if you ran the experiment again, is about 30%, right? So that's what that means. If you're feeling bad for psychologists, you really shouldn't, right? Because in the best estimates of replicability in the biomedical sciences, it's like 20%. It's much worse, mostly because there's lots of incentive to just lie in journals. But that's another story altogether. So I'm giving you some of my favorite experiments, but you know, they need to be repeated before we can work out whether or not they'll tell us anything new and interesting. I no longer speak to journalists because they're very annoying, but also because I think it's a sort of bad thing to do if you have a small set of studies and you think that the studies are good, right? But you want to repeat them a few times before I think we spread the nonsense to the general public. So I'm not taking my advice because I am spreading this to the general public, none of this is my work, so you know, I guess I get away scot-free. Okay, so like my favorite study of all time in the psychology of religion was done in this country by a guy called Bruce Hood, who's working with, I think, a graduate student. And a guy at Yale called Paul Bloom, and what he did was this, right? So he brought a bunch of kids, age 6 or so, didn't shoot them, and got all the kids to draw a picture, right? So they drew a picture, it was very fun, and then they sort of like put the picture aside, and then they said, all right, kids, come here, I'm gonna show you like this contraption, and it was like flashing lights and sounds and things like this, and it was a little box, and then they showed kids what would happen if you put like an object in the contraption. So they thought, like, here's a green wooden block, right? Put it in, close the thing, it whirs, right? And then open the thing, and then lo and behold, there are two identical green wooden blocks there. Because children are extremely stupid, and they did not see the experiment to put like a green block behind, when they were not looking. And then they do this a few times, right? So the kids sort of get it, right? The kids get that when you put an object in the thing, you close the thing, it whirs, you open it, and then two of them will appear. It's a duplicating machine. Like anyone who's read Calvin and Hobbes will get this immediately. But they did it a few times just in case some children did not read Calvin and Hobbes or are a little bit thick. And then they asked the kids, all right, what do you think happened? And they said, well, you know, like, it's a duplicating machine, fine. All the kids understood this. If they didn't understand this, they got kicked out because they were too stupid to do the experiments. and then they showed the child, like, a hamster, right? So here's a hamster, right? It's a very furry hamster. And then they tell the child, the hamster has a blue heart, and the children believe them because children are extremely stupid. And then the hamster also has a chipped tooth at the back where you can't see. Children believe them, same reason. Also... The reason that the hamster has a chipped tooth at the back of its mouth is because it swallowed a marble. Because it turns out that that hamsters also are incredibly stupid. So what we want you to do with children, with this hamster, is to show them the picture that you drew earlier, right? And then whisper your name into the hamster's ears, and then tickle the hamster. Yes, okay, right. And then, right, you will not be surprised to hear, they take the hamster, and then they put it in the duplicating machine, close the thing, it works, they open it up, lo and behold, two hamsters, right? So then tell the child, look, this was hamster one, which was the hamster that, you've met this hamster, and then it's hamster two, right? And you've not met this hamster, we just made it, right, in the box. I'm gonna ask you some questions. Well, the hamsters, right? So they asked the children in both cases, so for both hamster one, the original, hamster two, redux, whether or not, you know, this hamster has a blue heart, whether or not it has a chipped tooth, whether or not it's a marble in its tummy, whether or not it remembers the picture that you showed it, remembers whether it knows your name, whether it remembers being tickled by you earlier. Right. Okay, so yeah, roughly sort of 80% of kids, so okay, unsurprisingly, kids think that the original hamster just knows all of these things, right? All these things are true. Like, the hamster still has a blue heart, the duplicating machine did not change the anything about the marble, and the hamster still remembers all these things. So very, very high levels, most of the children go, yeah, of course that's a boring hamster, don't care about that. And then you ask the children about like the new sort of like fancy hamster that you've just made in a box. And 80% of them or so, right, so very high levels, will say that, yeah, like the physical attributes of hamster one are duplicated by the machine in the new hamster. Now, only sort of 40 or 50% of the kids are willing to say this about the psychological properties, about knowing about the tickling, knowing about the image that the child drew, and about like remembering that the child whispered its name into the hamster's ear. So what Bruce Hood and his team sort of got from this, so there were a bunch of studies, but this is the first one, was, well, it seems like children are distinguishing between sort of physical properties and sort of mental properties, right? Such that one is more amenable to duplication than the other. So they ran another version of the study where they compared what would happen if it was a hamster versus like a digital camera, right? So it was analogous sort of study. So they ran the hamster condition, and then the camera condition was like, it's like a blue battery, like a broken latch. So there were a bunch of physical properties, but also they took the camera and like they took photos of the child and got the child to talk into the camera the camera while it recorded its voice, and they did like a video recording of the child, and then they duplicated the camera and asked the child, well, you know, is your voice still in the thing, right? Does the camera remember your voice? Does the camera remember the video? Does the camera remember like the image that you took, right? Like, is that still there? And children, you know, the vast majority of the children thought, yeah, totally fine, right? When a camera gets duplicated, its internal contents get duplicated too. There's no much distinction being made here between physical properties per se and the properties that are inscribed upon the hard drives of like SD cards or whatever, right? So it turns out this is just for biological things. And the effect gets larger when you name the hamster, right? So we say, here's a hamster, its name is Timmy, and it goes into the duplicating machine. Here are two hamsters. Suddenly, like, not Timmy, right? Timmy Prime knows even less. Like, it's even fewer children want to say that Timmy Prime has the same memories as Timmy Alpha. So interesting, right? I think, right? It tells us something about how even very small children have these intuitions about distinctions between sort of physical properties and sort of non, as it were, depending on your metaphysical position, as it were, non-physical properties, at least sort of psychological properties, being metaphysically agnostic about the situation. And there are a bunch of studies that are related to this kind of thing that have shown very similar sorts of effects. So that's an example of a really clever study, I think, run on children. It's much easier to run things on children because, for all kinds of reasons, but in part because you can trick them in lots of very cute ways. Most grown-ups don't believe that hamsters have blue hearts, etc. So here's another study, right? So how many of you are familiar with the statue by Rodin called The Thinker? Mm-hmm. Right, okay. How many of you are familiar with a statue which is remarkably similar, which involves a disco, like a discus thrower? some of you, right? Okay, so it's very simple. Like, it's a guy. I don't really know what discus is, but anyway, it's like an athletic thing. I don't know anything about that. So these guys, sort of actually friends of ours, as it turns out. Like, I have a few colleagues in a room today. They ran a study in 2012 where they did a really like ridiculously simple thing, where they showed a bunch of people like photographs of the discus thrower, and then they showed another bunch of people photographs of the thinker. It turns out, right, that when you view photographs of the thinker relative to when you view photographs of the discus thrower, you're more likely to engage in what you might call sort of analytical thinking, right? So for example, working out like whether or not arguments are valid, right? So like, you know, Socrates is a human, all humans are animals, therefore Socrates is an animal, that kind of thing, right? Performing syllogistic reasoning. So it turns out that performance in syllogistic tasks is enhanced by looking at images of the thinker relative to the discus thrower. Now, if you don't believe me, I don't blame you, right? It sounds completely insane. Yeah, no, we'll get to that, So if you don't believe me, I don't blame you, like, let's just play along for now, right? Okay, like, let's just assume that that's the case. So then what they did was they showed the same photo, the same images, right? So one group saw the discus thrower, the other group saw the thinker, and then they measured religiosity by asking, you know, like, how, like, do you believe in God from a scale of 0 to 100, right? And then it turned out what they found was that the people who looked at pictures of the thinker score higher on sort of religious belief measure, lower on the religious belief measure than the people who view pictures of the discus thrower, right? So okay, what they infer from this is that the sorts of like conditions under which we sort of depress our analytic thinking sort of strategies are more amenable to us to leading to religious belief. Right, which is to say that there's something sort of antagonistic about analytical thinking, critical thinking, syllogistic thinking, right, of the kind that philosophers are used to doing, and religiosity. My colleague rudely interrupted earlier by saying that this finding does not replicate, and she's not wrong. So the original study had about 50 people in it. The replication had about 450 people in it, and over across four samples of different kinds, so community, like university samples and online samples. So they did a really good job getting lots and lots of data, and then they analyzed the data separately, but also in combination, and they just failed to replicate the finding. It turns out that this is probably not true. In fact, so one of their four samples in the replication study in 2017, I think, was from like a private Lutheran university, and in that case, the results were the other way around, right? So analytic thinking led to increased religiosity in that case. But you should believe none of this because it basically didn't replicate. So right, really cool study in many ways, right? Very interesting, but it's not true, right? Doesn't work. Doesn't hold up to scrutiny. Right. So final study before I finish off, and then you can ask questions. We'll talk about the difficulty of the enterprise to get the questions. This, I think, probably is my favorite study. So a bunch of students, I think mostly students, 100 people, 50% of whom believe in God, 50% of whom composite score of religiosity, right? So it's, do you believe in ghosts? Here's a scale. Do you believe in angels, God, the devil, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out, right, that unsurprisingly, people who believe in God, who reported belief in God before the experiment, also reported like higher levels of belief in all these other things, regardless of what condition they were in, right, relative to people who were atheists. But more interestingly, the people who were told that they were going to be alone for the rest of their lives also reported higher belief in supernatural agents. And there was no crossover effect. So it did not matter whether or not they were themselves a priori religious or not, right? So which is to say the scores, right, the effect of being told that you are going to be lonely for the rest of your life was very similar regardless of whether you said before the experiment whether you believe in God or not, right? So that's sort of cute. I like that. So there are a bunch of studies that have been run since then which are very similar, right? So like the effects of social ostracism on later religiosity, etc. But that gives you an idea, like I hope, about sort of the ways in which experimental psychologists at least study religion. Now, experimental psychology is a very sort of narrow field of psychology, right? Like, not all psychologists are experimental psychologists. There are lots of psychologists who are clinicians, right? And clinical research is a very different kind of thing from experimental psychological research. It can take many forms. Sometimes it involves just sort of like single participant case studies. Sometimes they involve randomized control trials for different kinds of therapeutic contexts. And then there are neuroscientists who put people in like neuroimaging machines or put electrodes on their faces or their heads. And then you've got people who mostly run correlational sort of like large scale surveys, right? Where the kinds of questions that we're trying to get at are asked not in an not in the lab, but in either in the field, right, in like in a village, etc., or in people's homes or over the internet. Where what we want to do there is to work out whether or not if we measure this thing, say some fact about your personality or some fact about your cognitive abilities like your IQ, how these things relate to, say, religious things, like the extent to which you believe in afterlife, something like this. So a lot of these are quite high profile studies in the psychology of religion are not experimental. They're these kinds of correlational studies, which are very interesting, but they, if you're an experimentalist, you sort of feel like there's something missing, right? Like you're just not nailing causation if you're not running an experiment, so which is why I sort of didn't really talk about them today. Look, studying humans is hard, right? It's hard for two reasons, two very big reasons, it really is why all of science is hard, which is that measurement is very hard, right, and manipulation is very hard, right. How many of you know how much you weigh? How many of you know how weighing scales work? Right, exactly, right. Like, sure, yeah, probably something about springs, right? Like, I don't really know. How many of you know what a kilogram is? Right, some of you do, right? I mean, go figure it out, right? Like, Google what a kilogram is later on. How do we know that 1 kilogram, like, on my scale is the same as the 1 kilogram on the scale down the street? And, I mean, as you know, very often if you weigh yourself in different places all the time, like, it's very unhealthy to do. You might know that it's not always true, right? That, weighing scales are notoriously unreliable. And also, like, none of you know how they work, right? I mean, how many of you know how the Large Hadron Collider works? Right, you know, it's not very complicated, right? I mean, it is the most complex machine in the world, but the principle is not that hard, right? How many of you have seen photographs, ostensibly photographs released by NASA of deep space? Okay, if the rest of you have not seen photographs of space, just leave now and like, stuff is beautiful, right? Like, how many of you know that, like, That stuff is colored in by technicians, mm-hmm. Right? So we, like, how many of you think that telescopes with which we use to see space look like telescopes that you could buy at the store with like lenses and a tube? How many of you think that? Oh. Right. Now half of you are pretending, right? Because that's exactly what you think, right? So what really big telescopes look like is a satellite dish, right? No lenses, no glass at all, right? How many of you know that the pictures that we show you, like with brain scans, like are just made up, like we make them up? Right. I mean, it's not strictly speaking true, right? Like we have data, and then we like interpret the data, right? And then suddenly we have like your brain is. I mean, how many of you know that your brain does not like flash green and red when you think? Right. Thank Christ for that. Right. So, like measurement is hard, and you have no idea how it's done, right? And measuring humans is hard too, right? Because the one thing that we have in common with physicists, the one thing that psychologists have in common with physicists, is that we also cannot see the things that we're most interested in, right? Like, we cannot see thoughts, we cannot see feelings. That's the only way in which psychology is like the study of Higgs bosons, right? Like, in both cases, what we're trying to do is to infer invisible things, the existence and nature of invisible things, from more visible things, from more or less visible things, right? So we use all kinds of techniques. We ask questions. We ask very indirect questions. We ask questions that annoy the hell out of our participants because they seem like very weird questions. We measure electrical signals in their faces. We measure things that go on. We measure like blood concentration, oxygen concentration in the blood in their brain, in very indirect ways using electromagnets. We measure reaction times, get them to press buttons when we flash things at them, all in the service trying to work out what's going on in their heads. And we're never entirely sure whether the thing that we're capturing with our measures is a real thing, right? Because measurement is hard. You don't even know how weighing scales work. And manipulation, I've already said, is hard also because we're not allowed to smash people together to see what they're made of. I don't have television, but I sort of wish I did, because sometimes I think that like we learn a lot about human beings from like the crazy things that people do on television, right? And like the only things that would never pass any self-respecting ethics committee that we put on television, like on like in like reality TV shows, right? Which are these like which you know, as it were, are kind of experiments, right? Like let's see what happens if you put people in a weird sort of situation. Now the manipulation and the control conditions are often terrible and non-existent, and their measurements are not any good. But you know, but in, the principle is sound, right? And but we don't get to do that, and therefore, you know, trying to put people in different conditions is hard. Like, we're like, you know, psychologists of religion don't have the luxury of like kidnapping a whole bunch of children and then like randomly distributing them into different kinds of households to see if they grow up religious. Like we don't get to do that. Thank Christ for that, right? Like they're like Nuremberg codes and Geneva conventions that I was told about when I first started this job, which I'm, you know, not allowed to do. So right, so the job is hard, right? Like our job is much harder than I think than biomedical scientists and physicists for this reason. Okay, I'm gonna stop now, and then you can ask questions. Cool. 40 minutes. I win. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was really interesting, fun. Has anyone got any questions off the top of their head that they'd like to ask?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, just to quickly, I didn't quite get the results of the study of you're going to die alone versus you're going to be happy. Can you repeat that?
Sure. Yeah. Right. So sorry, two conditions, and in both conditions, 50% of the people said that they believed in God, and 50% said they didn't. So that's true in both conditions, right? So that's just a fact about the composition. In one condition, they're told that, like, that they'll be fine in life, right? And in the other condition, they're told that they're going to be lonely for the rest of their lives. Right. So let's focus on the what happens when they're told that they'll be lonely for the rest of their lives kind of condition. Right. So these people, right, are report higher levels of belief in supernatural things, gods, ghosts, souls, angels, demons, etc. So these people report higher levels of that kind of belief than these people. Right. And that difference, that effect, is not affected by whether or not they said they were religious to begin with. Right, so regardless of whether you were a theist or an atheist, you were equally affected by the loneliness manipulation. So that's the finding.
Yeah. How long is the gap between being told you're going to be alone?
Pretty much immediate. So they didn't wait like 3 days or anything. I have the magnitudes here, I think. Do I have the magnitudes here? I think I do. The magnitudes are not massive, right? So on a sort of 10-point scale, the magnitude of the difference is a little bit more than half a point. Right, so these are very sort of small shifts, and that's true for a lot of psychological experiments. Where what we're not doing, right, is taking humans, putting them in a room, and then they come out like monks, or right, like that basically doesn't happen. I mean, some psychological studies are very dramatic, right? A lot of them are not replicable, but some of them are very dramatic. But like, just think about the conditions in which psychological experiments happen. You're in a lab, right? I mean, this is one of the big problems about studying religion, about studying anything, right? Studying anything interesting about humans is that you bring them in a lab, and that's just not where people fall in love or become or get religious experiences or whatever. Like, a psychology lab is not where any human does anything interesting, right? But that's where we have to study them, at least if you're committed to the method, right? You know, you could also be like a field researcher or a correlational expert, blah blah blah. But if you're interested in working in a lab, then there are these inherent limitations. The effects are very small.
It's more like a generic question. I was quite interested by this experiment with the rat. It's kind of like the mind body problem of this characteristics, right?
Yeah.
I just was wondering how is it the field right now? Because it's been a while since I haven't looked it up. Like, how is this discussion? Because I think one of the big problems for materialism is trying to reduce consciousness to matter. So how is this studies going?
Sure. So you're asking me what the like psychological and neuroscientific research looks like about the mind body problem, or you're asking me about like the philosophical literature?
Well, can we do both?
Okay, so this is slightly this is sort of slightly tangential to the talk, but okay. So here's the problem, right? A lot of people. So I will, by way of advertisement. On top of the other things that I do, I also help to run what is effectively a sort of glamorized blog called The School of Theology. It is just theschooloftheology.org. This Wednesday's post is about neuroscience and like belief about souls and things like this. So you might want to check that out. Okay, so here's the basic problem with work on psychological and neuroscience and questions about what humans are made of. Okay, for those of you who are not sort of well versed in the field, there's this basic question: how many kinds of stuff are humans made of? Right? Are we made of one kind of stuff that you might call matter, or are we made of two kinds of stuff that you might call matter and something else? Right? Like soul, spirit, mind, whatever, what have you? Right? So there are all kinds of problems with both sides of this debate, right? So the main problem on the dualist of the debate, right, humans are made of two kinds of stuff, is something called the interaction problem, right? If you have non-material stuff and you have material stuff, how do they interact such that the immaterial stuff is meant to cause things like consciousness and agency and experiences? Like, how do you solve, like, how does that work, right? What does it look like that non-material stuff and material stuff can interact to produce causal situations? There's a related problem which I think is sort of overplayed, which is about let's assume that neuroscience can explain all kinds of human phenomena, including our intentional and phenomenological experiences. If that's the case, then it seems like there's very little room left. There's no explanatory room left for non-material substances to play, in which case then they're redundant and we should not believe in them. In the same way that we don't believe in phlogiston or whatever, right? The planet Vulcan, two examples that I love. The problem with the materialist position is that the premise of its main argument is false, right? So as I said earlier, that the second problem that dualism faces is that if it's the case that neuroscience can explain all these things, then the soul is redundant. The problem is that's not what neuroscience does, right? So what neuroscientists do is we look at the correlates of the neural correlates of psychological states, right? And also the necessary conditions of psychological states, right? So how you do that is the extremely sketchy thing of oblating bits of brains out of animals, or looking at people with traumatic brain injuries, right? So we know a lot, much less than you might think, but we know a lot about what brain states correlate with what behaviors and what intentional states and what phenomenological states. We also know a lot about what happens when you damage parts of the brain. We know a lot about these two things. So we know a lot about correlates and necessary conditions. What we don't know anything about is sufficient conditions, because we can't build brains, right? Basically. So therefore, I mean, just the way we do neuroscience will never, like, you know, unless we change the way we do neuroscience, unless we build brains, right? We have nothing to say about dualism. Like, that's a metaphysical question. It's not a scientific one. That's the problem for philosophers and theologians to deal with. I don't know why neuroscientists and psychologists are bothered with this question all the time. Like, we should just stop. Yeah.
I would be curious. I asked you that question personally before, but for the sake of the conversation, I think it would be really interesting to talk about the two sides of your life and calling and work.
Sure.
It's sort of like you are wearing the collar today, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how intentionally or not. How do you do in context where you're facing a conflict or seeming contradiction, say, you know, angels, demons, and other agents, and, you know, from the science of religion, say, can explain or explain away
sure.
our experience of those, but at the same time, you are, then, kind of committed to some sort of orthodoxy.
Yeah, sure.
So, have you, like, is that a good example, or can you give some other examples of conflict where
okay, so,
you deal with those?
Right, so my religious position is that I believe most of what the Pope believes. But I've better positions on women and the LGBTQ community, so I'm more progressive than the Pope is on those things and almost nothing else. We're basically equally conservative on almost everything else. So I believe all the right things basically. Right, if you are like conservative Orthodox Christian with like very progressive politics, okay. So there I think two. I think that I always say two things about this. One is that I don't really ever know where the conflict arises, right? So there are lots of questions that humans have about the world, and some of them are empirically tractable questions, right? Does paracetamol work to reduce headaches? in the face of extremely loud and terrible music, right? Does the fear of death increase religious belief? Do children assume that there is some kind of interesting difference between physical states and non-physical and psychological states? These are empirical tractable questions. And then you have questions like the composition of the metaphysical composition of the human person and the clues in the name, right? These are metaphysical questions, which for the most part, for the very most part, are not amenable to empirical investigation. So in which case, I guess, like, I just never really see where the conflict arises. It's true to say that one of the things that people often say is, well, you know, there's stuff about like explaining beliefs away, right? But it's not clear to me how the argument gets off the ground, right? Like, psychologists are in the business of explaining all human phenomena, right? Like, we're interested in explaining why we fall in love, why we're interested in doing science, why we find mathematics catchy, why we believe in gods, why we vote Democrat or Republican, why we believe murder is wrong, right? Where we wear why we wear trousers. Unless you think that any explanation of a human phenomenon is an undermining one, in which case you're in a lot of trouble, right? Then it's a weird kind of special pleading to think that our political beliefs are untouched, or like liberal progressive ideals are untouched, but our religious beliefs are immediately sullied by psychological explanations. But that's just insane, right? That's a stupid thing to believe. So that's one side. I will say that here's the hard thing about being an academic psychologist. One is academia is a Ponzi scheme, right? You have to be craven, amoralist to be an academic. And so I go to confession a lot. So religion is extremely helpful. So kidding aside, there is a difficulty if you're a psychological scientist with the fact that you spend most of your time thinking of humans as cells in a spreadsheet, right? As bundles of phenomena to be manipulated and measured, right? And this is an extremely perverse way to think of a human being, right? Because that is what human beings are, right? Human beings are bundles of sensations and perceptions to be manipulated, but that's not all they are, right? You know, like I and therefore the fact that today, besides designing experiments in which I precisely treat humans like cells on a spreadsheet, I also went to visit a 93-year-old and talked about what it was like when she was in India as a small child, and we talked about her mother, because she had just received from one of her visitors an old black and white photograph of her mother. Like, that part of my life, right, allows me to be a properly functioning, more or less, human being, given what I do in the daytime, which is to think of humans as cells in a spreadsheet. And I don't know if I could do the science if it weren't for the thing that I do as a priest, right? Because that reminds me that humans are not just like bits of data.
I take what you mean about explanations are explanations, they don't undermine other explanations necessarily. I'm thinking about the design of experiments and where do you think kind of do you see this in how you design experiments and how colleagues design assumptions about what you're looking for, and maybe you don't want to look for something specifically, but why are we testing these things? Like, you know, why are we testing whether children think that the hamster knows their name or whatever? Like, what do we think that means? Like, where does interpretation come into it?
Sure. So there are a few ways to answer the question. I think so philosophers of science, how many of you are philosophers of science?
Philosophers of science.
Okay. So philosophers of science distinguish between the context of discovery and the context of justification, right? The context of justification is the data collection part, right? You collect data to falsify or verify your hypothesis. The context of justification is how you come up with the idea in the first place, right? And strictly speaking, all else being equal, the context of discovery doesn't matter. Right, so the famous story of the discovery of the structure, the ring structure of benzene, is that the guy who dreamt up the structure literally just dreamt it up in his sort of bachelor's scholar's quarters in Ghent. He was daydreaming one day and he imagined in his boredom and delirium a snake biting its own tail, and he goes, aha, benzene has a ring structure, because that makes all fucking sense. It turns out he was right, right? But the fact that he came up with this idea just like slightly giddy in a room that was too warm, is neither here nor there, Right, so that's the kind of first thing to be said about the relationship between how we come up with hypotheses and how we test them. Now, I do think that that your relationship to religion per se as an individual makes a little bit of a difference, right? So some people are looking for something. Some people are looking for a premise to an argument they want to make for their position, right? So you know, I have work colleagues, I have collaborators who are very interested in asserting that religion is like a natural and fundamental part of human beings because they want to say something about how that's good, right? And then you can evaluate the argument. And so they're motivated to find a sort of naturalness about religiosity, right? I have other work colleagues who also want to find that religious belief is natural in this kind of way, whatever that means. But they want to do so because they have arguments that use the same premise in the opposite direction, right? So as it were, even there, the motivation for finding out the thing only really comes, like, doesn't really come into play, right? What does come into play is whether or not the premise works in your argument, right? So I think you got to keep these things separate, the kind of motivation for the data collection, the theory itself, the empirical theory itself, and the philosophical uses to which you put them. The thing that's more interesting to me is observing my work colleagues, some of whom are here today, about the way they come up with hypotheses about religion. Without wanting to offend anybody, people who are not religious generally say very stupid things about religion, right? Because they don't know anything about religion, right? I mean, it's like, look, say you've never fallen in love, right? And then you come up with like hypotheses about why people fall in love. Like, it's not that surprising if you come up with quite silly ideas, right? And that is true for religion too, right? If you're not religious yourself, if you don't know any religious people, your hypotheses come from like where exactly, right? They come from reading books. They come from sort of like you being very clever, but it wouldn't be that surprising when you're kind of off the mark by quite a lot, right? And so I think that there are situations where being religious is not helpful when you're studying religion because you don't have enough objective distance. But I think there are also cases where being like religiously autistic is also not very helpful because you don't know where to start, right? Except a bunch of books that like old dead Victorian men wrote, something like this. Right? So there we go.
Is there a question at the back?
Thank you very much because you're very simple. I like this kind of playing bit, but I try to see the conflict. For example, if the God created man totally free, and you mentioned several times, and you in psychology, what you try to do, manipulate with people. And I'm asking you a question today, manipulating people in the 20th century or the 50s or 60s, you manipulate by the television, newspaper, or something. But these days, can you see the power of the manipulation? It's you have the conflict, you have the man have to be free.
Sure.
And you have the profits, money, you have to manipulate with people. Doesn't matter buying the shoes, buying ice cream, anything. You manipulate with them.
Yeah, okay.
And
so
the psychology working on some points to understand the psyche of the man, how are you going to manipulate it? It's all about domination, power. And
yeah, so
and
so
you see these two conflicts.
So I think that there are two levels of this kind of question, right? So one is a straightforward causal question: is it the case that our behaviors or attitudes are shaped, right? To use a more neutral word, by all kinds of external forces that we know nothing about, and about which we have much less control than other people who are more powerful than us, right? So that's a straightforward causal question, right? Is it the case that advertisers and politicians, etc., have some kind of like subtle power over us that we find very hard to escape from? So that's one level of the question. You know, perfectly good empirical question to ask. My best guess is probably yes. I don't have data to bear upon this, but I think most of you probably think that that's true too, right? That lots of our decisions are driven by the ads we see on Facebook or you know, whatever political ads are on television at the moment or whatever, right? And then there's the kind of more moralized version of the question, right? Which is that, like, is this tantamount to manipulation, right? And then that from that question, you can spin off to asking either a straightforwardly political question, which is like, what do you do about it, right? What do we do about the fact that we're being pushed around by capital? And you can ask a metaphysical question, which is, does this undermine our freedom, right? Under what conditions does external causal power on our behaviors and attitudes? To what, under what conditions is that phenomenon a threat to our freedoms? I think like a dose of believing that being manipulated by capital, I think believing that that does undermine our sort of personal autonomy is like a healthy perspective, right? I think it does depend on your anthropology. It depends on what you think the human person is constituted of. It depends a bit on your sort of moral theology, right? Like what, like when what the conditions do you think that we're morally responsible for our behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. But like I think it's healthy to think that, yeah, we're being manipulated by powers unseen. And that this is a bad thing, and that this undermines what it means to be a human being in a kind of like in the most positive of all possible senses. The more interesting question, I think, right, is like what are you going to do about that, right? What are you going to do about the fact that that our politics and our economics are being shaped by forces that are not just us as individuals, or better yet, us as intentional communities. Right. I think the kind of like fetishization of individual autonomy is itself a kind of ideology that has shaped us, right? So you guys, right? This is your job, right? You guys start thinking about like what are the pernicious and what are the positive causes of human behavior, and how do we cultivate the positive ones, and how do we reject the pernicious ones?
I guess first a comment. I would never call children stupid. I think they are creative and have immense amount of imagination, and I think adults are dumb. But my question is, so there are lots of assumptions in psychology about religion, that religion is for the weak, religion is for aging, religion is for manipulation. What is your take on these like common theories about why people are religious and believe in?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that they're assumptions, right? They're hypotheses. It's a good guess, right? It's a good guess. So here's a good guess, right? Like, people who are, like, psychologically weak, measured in some way, are more religious than people who are psychologically robust. Perfectly testable hypothesis, right? Have some measure of psychological resilience and have some measure of religiosity and see how the chips fall. Here's another good guess, right? Psychology is for old people, right? Fine, right? Let's see if that's true, right? Measure age, measure religiosity. Let's see where the chips fall. I don't think it's right to say that these are assumptions that psychologists have. These are just questions that psychologists have, that they try their best to bring data to bear on these questions, and sometimes the data fall in ways that confirm these hypotheses, and sometimes they don't. Very often it's very messy. Very often it's very culturally contingent, so that something that's true about, for example, the relationship between age and religiosity might be true. Something might be true in one country and not true in another country. So I have some data. There's very good data on the relationship between age and religiosity in America, and most studies show a negative relationship, so that older people tend to be more religious. We don't know why, right? We don't know whether or not it's because as you get older you actually get more religious, or whether it's just a cohort effect. But that correlation doesn't apply in Japan, it doesn't apply in South Korea, it doesn't apply in Brazil, it doesn't apply, what else do I have data on this? It doesn't apply in China, I think. So there are a bunch of places where it's not true, but in the States, right, like there are a bunch of studies that do show the finding, and I think in New Zealand it's true too. You have a sort of negative correlation between age and religiosity. So no, I mean, you know, these are perfectly good guesses. Like I don't particularly, and you might have guessed, I don't particularly care where the guesses come from, right? They might come from like a belligerent anti-religiosity, or they might come from a sort of like a desire to like justify religiosity in some way, right? But all I care about is whether or not the question is well posed, and whether or not we can measure and manipulate the relevant things so that we can answer the empirical question.
Still on a matter of this conflict, if you have, because if you're religious or not, you have two different premises or axioms or whatever about the universe that are very, very different, and if you don't take care of how you approach these questions, you're kind of going to, maybe you're going to make your experiments slightly biased, or the approach, even a discussion, is going to be quite biased. And if you're giving the example you gave before, people are motivated by finding a pattern, that's terrible, at least like something in science that we try not to do, right? You shouldn't be looking for the answer you want to find. And you see a lot of that going on, and you see how much that influenced discussions in many papers, and that they don't find what they did, instead of saying, maybe there's no effect, they're like, oh, maybe I didn't look hard enough, right. Let me do it again. So can you see in your field, how is this bias going on? Do you see people being pretty careful about making them, or
no,
you see research?
No. I mean, psychological science is like every other science, right? Like, because academia is a Ponzi scheme, the incentive structures in academia are perverse, right? Everyone wants to publish significant results in the best journals and for their theory to be propagated, et cetera, et cetera, in ways that are more or less orthogonal to the theories being true. But this is true in physics, in biomedical science, and in psychology. This is true everywhere. This is why, right, you don't trust individual scientists, right? This is why you trust the community, where we police one another. The great thing about science is that Valerie sitting in front of me will run an experiment, right? And I can go, I don't like her face, I'm gonna take the experiment and then replicate it, right, and see if it works, right? If it doesn't work, then we have a problem. If it does work, then like, look, you know, I've confirmed your finding, right? So this is the great thing about science. The great thing, like, the scientific revolution has very little to do with people getting cleverer, right? It's not like people were cleverer in the 15th century. Like, what we did was our tools got better, right? Like, a bunch of very clever people, it's true that they were very clever, invented a bunch of maths. One very clever guy decided that instead of looking at ships with a spyglass, he could turn it to heaven, right? But more to the point, we formed societies, right? The Royal Society was formed, and then suddenly a bunch of mostly dudes, right, gathered together and, like, kind of, like, ribbed each other about their findings. And from there, from the foundation of scientific societies, we grew this great thing that we call science. Because you're like, I don't have to take your word for it, or you don't take my word for it. What I can do is take the study that you've described in the paper, run it, and see what happens. Right. So no, like, we don't, you know, I mean, we trust each other to some extent, right? But we trust each other. We don't necessarily trust each other's findings, and that's not a bad thing.
You know the Oxford, there is a group, the professor tried to figure out how you can manipulate love in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I know 2 years ago it was some kind of debate. And I saw him when he's talking about love here in the modeling college. And he's very certain he's going to find out how you can exactly feel the love.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, it's a... in the points of psychology, if you can manipulate with people, they can fall in love. It doesn't matter group, you still manipulate with them and you play.
Right. So is the claim that this is a bad thing?
I think I'm asking you, is it a bad thing?
So yeah. So I mean, I think trying to investigate what the neurobiological foundations of love, like, that is, as it were, morally neutral, right? Like, look, you know, here's a, you know, we can run studies and try and figure out what happens in your brain when you're falling in love, and that's very interesting, you know. But I think there's a separate step, which is precisely not a scientific step, to then go, here's what we know, now I'm gonna, like, make a pill and make people fall in love with me, right? Like, that's a moral step, right? Right, so like, I think it's a mistake to think that step is science, right? The science is trying to work out what happens in your brain, right? I mean, you know, it's the same as like trying to work out how to make H2O, H3O, right? That's perfectly like reasonable science. Like, no one told you to then take hard water, heavy water, and turn it into an ingredient for atom bombs, right? Like the scientists didn't tell you to do that. Right, like it's right, like people making moral decisions do that kind of thing. So I don't want to draw too strong a separation between fact and value, right? Because I do think that there is like an interesting relationship between the nature of things and what the account of the good is, right? But I think at least distinguishing between the things that we do to investigate facts about the world is a different phenomenon from acting to change facts about the world, right? And they're different for lots of very interesting reasons, right? So I've mentioned very bad things so far, right? Here's some physics, let's make a bomb, right? Here's some neurobiology, let's manipulate humans, right? But you can flip that around, which is like, you know, we know a lot about the plight of this planet, right? We know a lot about climate change, we know a lot about poverty. I mean, very few of us are doing anything about it, Right, so it turns out that lots of facts, right, don't lead to value-laden decision-making in the positive direction. Right, so like, while a lot of people scaremonger and worry about, you know, like, what are we going to do with these scary facts, I would like to ask what we're doing with the currently scary facts, which is fuck all, right? We're doing very little that's good with the facts that we already have. I'm not sure why we should be worried about the terrifying facts.
I have a question about, so when you talk about religiosity, in your experience, do experiments distinguish between types of religiosity in terms of religions?
Yeah.
So obviously to be a Christian is very different to being a Buddhist.
Absolutely. So yeah, so I considered talking a little bit more about how we measure religiosity. Instead, I spoke in generalities. And maybe this was a mistake. So this is a hard game, right? When we say that someone is more religious, less religious, like what on earth does that mean? This is not like measuring mass, where there's only like basically one account of how heavy you are, right? So what psychologists generally do is we try and sidestep the problem of defining religion, right? We try not to get into those debates that anthropologists and philosophers have with each other. What we do instead is we go, look, right, like, we're using the word religion and religiosity as a convenient term for this thing that we're looking at. And this thing that we're looking at in this study might not be the thing that you're looking at in your study. So like, we gotta be really careful when we read papers, right? So different people in the different studies that they run are looking at specific different phenomena. So my main interest is in people's sort of like beliefs about supernatural and invisible powers, right? So in the rabbit study, that particular interest was the distinction between physical and psychological states, right? Like the separation between these two things. Some people are interested in particular kinds of behaviors that you might call ritualistic, right? So the answer is yes, right? We measure all kinds of things. We define religion in all kinds of ways and try to avoid defining things with a capital D, as it were, right? So we have sort of what we call operational definitions. So the way we use the word religion and religiosity really just is, look, here's a convenient term we're going to use, and we mean this thing. So I think this is the thing to be careful about. When you see news articles about psychological studies or neuroscience studies about religion, do pay attention about what they mean, right? Sometimes they mean, like, Buddhists meditating. Sometimes they mean people who believe in aliens, right? And, like, these are, you know, these may or may not have anything to do with one another, right? So do be a bit careful about that kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any correlation between like personality type and predisposition to religious?
Yeah. So I might get this wrong. Almost all personality tests are terrible. The least terrible of the personality tests is based on what's called the five-factor personality theory, right? So I cannot bother listing the five. I'll get it wrong probably. So I'm not mistaken, there's replicable findings that neuroticism and agreeableness are positively correlated with religiosity, at least in Western contexts. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there are other psychologists or religion who can confirm that or falsify that, but anyway. I think that's right. I recently reviewed a paper which showed that the correlation for, I think, neuroticism was less stable than we thought before. So it turns out that like agreeableness is higher among religious people. People used to think that openness to experience is lower, but actually that's quite hard to replicate. Like some studies show it, some studies don't. Yeah.
And what about like, does that open up implications for kind of like what the gentleman back was saying with free will, in terms of if we are kind of just responding to our environment and our brain chemical makeup, and if some people are not predisposed to religious beliefs, then what do you do with that from this, you know?
Yeah, I mean, so that depends on whether. So okay, so this is big old debate in when people think about, you know, human agency, is like whether or not your account of like moral responsibility and positive assertions that humans are free, right? Whether these sorts of assertions are consistent with different pictures of causation in the world, right? So the main kind of contention is something like, you know, can we still say that humans are free and are responsible, morally responsible for their acts, if it's the case that we live in a deterministic universe, where in principle at least you can account for causation with reference perfectly to a bunch of like physical motion, something like this, right? And whether or not you think the answer is yes or no to that question, is up for grabs, right? So you can be what you call an incompatibilist, right? And you can say, well, you know, my account, like, in order to be satisfied for my account, in my account of freedom and moral responsibility, the world cannot be deterministic, and then you have a set of arguments for those. But, you know, but I think, so it turns out that most professional philosophers, you know, this is a sociological claim, not a philosophical argument, most professional philosophers are compatibilists. So they think that determinism is perfectly consistent with accounts of at least moral responsibility, if not also the freedom of the will. And it, like, I don't really have stake, I don't have skin in this game, right? Like, it's not a thing that I work on. But it's not a scientific question, right? It's a sort of metaphysical one. So you just have to work out what you think about the relationship between determinism and freedom. Yeah.
What do you think about these studies indicating that there's a genetic correlation with religiosity? And so it's like, for example, that if identical twins are reared apart, there's a correlation between them being religious or not, which is stronger than if they're non-identical twins. Which
yeah, are so... So there are a bunch of studies like that, so that's true. I forget what so there's a statistic that geneticists use called the heritability statistic, H2. So for example, the heritability of IQ is about 0.8, right, out of 1, so it's high correlation, between familial relation and standardized test intelligence. What do I make of them? I mean, you know, it's perfectly possible that there are genes that are correlated with religiosity. I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to think, right? It's a perfectly good guess. Let's find out if it's true. Genetics is hard. Genetics is hard in part because, for the same reason that psychology is hard, because we can't, you know, we can study twins reared apart, but we can't take humans and split them up, right? We can't run perfect experiments in this sort of way. And one of the problems with inferring the causal role of particular genes from statistical data like this is that the variation in genetic variable in genetic factors and a variation in environmental factors is non-equal, and therefore it's very hard to compute. It's very hard to know what to make of the heritability statistic given that that's the case, right? So if we live in a world where we can have if we can manipulate genes in all of logical space, and if we can manipulate environmental conditions in all of logical space, then the heritability system makes a lot of sense, right? We can very easy to interpret that, right? But that's not true, right? Because we have the sample of genes that we have is small, right, and bumpy, and the access to conditions that we have to put these genetic variations in is also small and lumpy, and therefore the heritability statistic is much less useful than people realize. And this is a complicated argument to make. There's a very good paper in this by Elliot Sober from the 1980s called Apportioning Causal Responsibility, which is very, very good on this point. Like, I find it quite hard to describe without diagram. But the point is that it's very hard to run these experiments in ways that the numbers make any sense. Put it this way, here's an example, right? Let's say that we have a bunch of seeds that vary genetically, right? But all we have are like very dry soil or quite dry soil, right? And then we put the seeds in the ground, and then we see that some seeds grow like crazy, and some seeds don't grow at all. And then you might be led to believe that genes play a very large role in the height of the plant. But the only reason you think that is because the variation in the soil that you have, the samples of soil they have, is very small. So you don't get to see the causal role of the soil because you don't have enough variation in the sample of the soils they use, right? That's a very simple example of why these studies are difficult to interpret.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's no more questions. I guess we'll wrap up.
Cool.
Everyone is very welcome to stay around and talk more and ask more questions. Have any, I'll just remind those who've been before about the donation box. It'd be really great if you could give pounds towards that. Next week, we will be in the MITRE. The plan is to have a guided tour that will be confirmed later this week. I hope it's a little bit uncertain at this point. A guided tour of Oxford is the original plan. And then in 2 weeks' time, we'll be back here again. And Marie, I'm set here, who's an apologetics expert, maybe a little bit. No, I'll not say that. He's going to be talking about living with questions, is the title we have at the moment. He's going to be thinking about apologetics and. Doubt and faith. So I encourage you all to come along to that. There'll be more information coming out soon about that. That's in 2 weeks' time here. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Actually, quick plug. Right, School of Theology.
Aye.
Right. And then, so we have a book coming out in February called Love Makes No Sense, which is a basic introduction to Christian theology, where I pretend to be a theologian for two chapters, and then quickly become a psychologist again.
Thank you.
Thanks.